Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Mickey 17. Bong Joon-ho's new feature is out. Man, it's so weird. They shot this in like 2022 and it has been sitting on ice, no pun intended. It is finally here. Warner Brothers doesn't really have it out during awards season. Is it going to win anything? Is it just a weird sci-fi? Why isn't it doing that good at the box office? We're going to talk about all that. We're also going to take a look at this new Netflix movie, Chaos, The Manson Murders. A documentary, true crime, right? True to form for Netflix, but importantly, from director Errol Morris, who, if you don't know who he is, he won Best Documentary in 2003. He kind of helped pioneer what documentaries are today with his work in The Thin Blue Line. Like, kind of incredible. And so I'm really excited to talk about this one. This is not like other Netflix docs, I swear. Stick around for the review. We're going to take a look at some television. Prestige TV, which is something that's been hotly requested here on Off Script, but we've never actually
out of our box.
Dude, I know. I'm very excited to dig into it. We're going to take a look at Amazon Prime's Invincible. We're also going to take a look at Apple TV Plus's Severance. Andy and I are very stoked to talk about these, so stick around for that in between our reviews. Before we get to all of it, we need to get to the news. Before we get to the news, Andy, I got to know, what have you been watching this week? What have you been watching when you're not watching other stuff for the podcast?
I was doing a little bit of traveling this week, but I still managed to get in a film or two. And I rewatched Everything Everywhere All at Once earlier in the week. And it's been a while since I saw it. And that film just always blows me away. And every time I think that, oh, I have a good idea for a movie or a good premise or something, and then I see something like this that's so unbelievably creative, that is this multiverse story that's also about family trauma and overcoming that, and that it almost has like a comic book-esque start, and then, but the climax isn't a big punch-up. It's a woman trying to save her daughter from nihilism, essentially. Just still hits. It's an incredible movie, and it still hits.
Yeah, dude. That was my favorite film of the year that year when it came out, and I've revisited it since. I think I was warmest on it the first time through. Every time since, like rewatching it, that you definitely start to see the seams and kind of just how simple it is in presentation, but also like how charming it is and having this like energy that rolls you through the whole movie, from like things going wild at the office to like portals opening and people hopping through space and time. Like somehow it all manages to work and it's like meaningful and emotional. That movie rocks. When did you rewatch it? Just early this week?
Yeah, about this time last week. It was actually, I think, not long after the Oscars, actually. So
nice. I have been down on late night watches when you can't sleep and you're just up watching something. First, I checked out Glass Onion, The Knives Out Mystery. Glass Onion rocks, dude. That's a movie I think I like more every time I see it. First time I was like trying to catch the clues and like see how Rian Johnson was going to twist me up after Knives Out, and totally manages to subvert expectations and work, and I think it's great. And I know I have some friends that watched it when it came out and were sour on it. Ah, it's too gimmicky. Ah, it's dumb. I don't like that it like stops halfway through and reset. I'm like, no, Glass Onion's cool. I'm really looking forward to Wake Up Dead Man when that comes out. And I checked out Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which we covered on this show. We also covered Glass Onion and Everything Ever All at Once. You boys have been doing Off Script for a minute. You can go check out our old reviews. Did not hold up as good as I remembered. Great character drama. Dude, everybody's in that movie. Like Sam Rockwell, Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson. But like, man, it's such a heavy script. You remember what that movie's about? Like,
yeah. Now I'm remembering the subplots and things.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, like Woody Harrelson's got cancer and he's like, I'm not going to make it. And Frances McDormand's like, I don't care. You let my daughter die. Like, it's brutal, dude. Like, also, Sam Rockwell is delightful. He's just this total buffoon, like local sheriff, who's ultimately not a great guy. But anyway, we got to talk about the news. We got to get into it. For our first story this week, AMC Theaters wants to roll back the clock. All right, roll back the clock to the dawn of time. It turns out AMC CEO Adam Aaron wants to return to the 45-day theatrical window, right? When movies used to be in theaters for a month and a half. Andy, what's going on? Why don't we do this anymore? Why are movies coming and going so quickly?
So theaters aren't keeping movies in as long. And this kind of happened after, during the pandemic, they revisited the theatrical window, which used to be a full 90 days, which is a pretty long time to wait before something could go to like rent or streaming. And so there was some wheeling and dealing. I mean, a lot changed during that time. But Universal had long wanted to experiment with what they call premium video on demand, PVOD, where something could come to a streaming rental sooner after maybe 20-30 days for a premium of like $20-$25. And Universal had wanted to do that for a long time, and because theaters were closed, AMC said, sure, let's try, you know, theaters are largely closed, we don't have a lot of product, let's try this for now. And so that's where we got these new terms where you could do, it shortened the window to maybe 45 days. And then it was also based on performance. If a movie does very poorly, opens less under $50 million, then it can go to PVOD as soon as 17 days, so 2.5 weeks from release. And, you know, it just kind of depends. Disney still largely sticks to the 60-day model, but a lot of people have criticized this and saying, well, you've trained audiences to stay home because if they want to see something, they'll just wait 2 weeks and it'll be out. But it's a bit of a catch-22. Audiences don't go to the theater because it's going to be available on streaming, and it's available on streaming because audiences don't go to the theater. Ultimately, I don't think it really helps the theater to just keep movies that no one's going to see. But the thing is, you can't really go back to the old ways. AMC would love to go back to at least 45 days, if not longer. But it's just too profitable, I think, for the studios. Keep in mind, the studios keep more of the money off PVOD and more, like, once it goes to digital rentals, as opposed to in theaters where they only keep about 50%.
It's such a weird relationship that studios and movie theaters have, right? Yeah, because you hit the nail on the head. Like, it is in the studio's best interest for a film not really to be in theaters all that long. Like, the quicker consumers can get it themselves, the higher cut a studio makes just renting it straight to you on VOD or putting it on something like Netflix. Running it through theaters means theaters get a cut. Not much, but they can also charge concessions on top of that and a premium for ticketing online, right? And getting people to buy their tickets early. Adam Aaron is well aware of this, right? This is something his company, AMC, does very well, specifically with their, like, first AMC Stubs program, right? And getting to go see 4 movies a month. Like, obviously, they have a lot of success with this. But yeah, I think it's a bit of a pipe dream, dude. Like, I don't think we can really turn back the clock here. I saw a kid's movie, Dog Man, went to VOD 18 days after coming out in theaters, dude. Like, and that's what we're talking about here, like a 17-day window, right? It's like almost nothing. That is so crazy from when I was younger and wanted to see a kid's movie. And if you didn't see it in theaters, you had to wait like 4 months for it to come out. People don't work that way anymore. I don't think the internet works that way anymore, right? And even if you want your movies to hang out in theaters for 45 days, 90 days, I don't even know if that's all that good for marketing. Like, part of the reason Baby Girl sold well is because people were posting GIFs online, dude. Like, and then it got out of theaters pretty quick and moved along. I don't know. I think you kind of step on it a little bit if you leave movies in theaters like in purgatory for 45 or, God forbid, 90 days. I know it works sometimes. All right. Tom Cruise is big on this. Like, Top Gun Maverick was out for a while. I know Mission Impossible kind of had the same thing. He's got his whole deal with Paramount. But people like Sean Baker, who just won a few Oscars for Anora, like, and said in one of his 4 acceptance speeches, like, we should get back to this old formula. Like, I hear you. I see you. I just don't know if consumers want to do it. You know what I mean? And like, that's ultimately where the money comes from.
Yeah. And again, a lot of it has to do with the performance. You can almost tell from opening weekend, you know, you get a smash hit, something that meets or exceeds expectations. Yeah. You can keep it in theaters longer, but if something flops, if it's a dud right away, it's like, get it into the hands of the people so that you can start to recover some money. And that's what I think the studios have found, is like, it's better financially for them to have the option to go to VOD sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it's tough. Like, I you know what? One thing's for sure, AMC will be fine. They got their investors program, and they got it all worked out. No worries about AMC. Something we should be keeping an eye on is Sadie Sink from Netflix. Stranger Things, specifically. You might remember her from the last season. She is going to be starring in the new Spider-Man movie. Spider-Man 4 with Tom Holland. That's right. They're making another Spider-Man. Didn't you know? Haven't you been keeping up with this? Well, we got the details for you from Variety. Andy, what do you know about Sadie Sink jumping on a Spider-Man?
So this was just announced today, and we don't actually know what role, and so everyone is speculating. The Hot Money says that Sadie Sink is either going to be playing someone like Gwen Stacy or a new version of Mary Jane, which was previously played by Zendaya. Or there's some speculation that she could be playing Jean Grey, introducing the famous X-Men, who's always kind of has a headache and is super useful. So we'll see. Sadie Sink, of course, became well-known, kind of a household name from Stranger Things. I think she shows up in the second or third season. She was also in The Whale, which is not listed among her accolades. It's an Oscar-winning film, which she was in. And she has a big role. It's not like a small thing. But the other thing about this is this new Spider-Man 4 comes out next summer, July 2026. So it's a ways off. And Tom Holland's getting a little old for this role because, like, Spider-Man is famously a teenager.
I think it's three Spider-Man movies and these couple of Avengers movies, and he's got to hand it off. Well, three would be great, just do another trilogy, but we'll see what happens. As for Sadie Sink joining, I figured it'd be a Gwen Stacy role. It is much more interesting for her to be some sort of X-Men plant. Like, that would be particularly succinct, especially because I think we're supposed to be getting X-Men somewhere around New Avengers. Like, good, lay that groundwork now. That's the whole reason we got Tom Holland as Spider-Man, right? He shows up in, what, Civil War, I think was his first appearance? He's right. Just some kid that, like, Stark's talking to until he shows up in the Spidey fit. Like, it's kind of cool. I don't know. So we'll see. We'll see what they do with there. I know that this movie is not going to be directed by our previous director, John Watts, who did the first three films. This one's going to be from Destin Daniel Cretton, who directed Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings. Have not seen a Marvel movie from him in a minute, but Shang-Chi was fine, honestly. And I think this one will probably be good, too. I know it's speculated to come out on July 31st, 2026. We'll see if Disney can actually hit that date. Otherwise, I don't know. What do you think? X-Men, Gwen Stacy, something else? Andy?
I mean, Disney has taken so long. We've talked about this before. They acquired 20th Century Fox in 2019 with that the X-Men property. And we have yet to really see. They've been teasing a lot of X-Men stuff in their films, but they haven't actually made an X-Men film. And we don't know if it's when, and it's going to be forever. It's going to be 2040 by the time we see X-Men on screen. Old man Peter is going to grace the screens before. Really getting too old for that role, man. You gotta hang up the tights.
Hey, I just saw some set photos of him on the set of Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. He's looking good. He's got it together, baby. He's going to be the new Chris Nolan star. Disney, meanwhile, has much bigger problems before Spider-Man 4 comes out. Dude, apparently Snow White is not looking good. This is a report from The Hollywood Reporter. We've got insiders at Disney saying, quote, they need to get this over with. Inside Disney's Snow White troubles. It seems like maybe they're placing a little blame on Rachel Zegler and Gal Gadot. I'm not sure those are exclusively the reasons this movie isn't working. But it seems like this Snow White's just not going to make a bunch of money. It's not going to be a $1 billion picture. It's not going to do Little Mermaid numbers. What, like, is this a disaster in the making, Andy? A snowball we can't get out of the way of? What do you think?
I mean, where do you even start? I mean, these live-action remakes are very hit and miss. Some of them are billion-dollar movies. Some of them are flops, like Dumbo, which no one even remembers. That might have gone straight to Disney Plus as well. But also, there was controversy just in casting Rachel Zegler as Snow White because she is of Colombian descent and has darker skin. People were upset about that. She kind of disparaged the movie inadvertently, the original. She's like, oh, I wasn't really a fan. It kind of scared me as a kid, and it's also like it needs to be up. She was like, yeah, it's kind of outdated, like,
yeah,
you know. So she got accused of being too woke, and then she had some political comments after the election. Gal Gadot has been also a controversial figure as well, as she's an Israeli actress. So it's just been like trouble the entire production. There's a whole thing about the dwarves. First of all, they're leaving off the seven dwarves part of the title. They're all CGI as opposed to actual roles. And it's just like, and so what Disney has done is they've cut like all promo. A lot of the promo has just been cut down. Usually they'll do pre-sale tickets a month in advance. They only started those 2 weeks in advance. They're not doing any red carpet. That way the actors aren't getting pressed for questions on the spot, and they're opting to do some sort of family friendly something. But they're almost just like, just get this movie out. Just get it out of the way, move it to PVOD, like we said, get it on Disney Plus, and then we'll move on with our lives. I just want to get this done.
Yeah, it reminds me of how they seem to be approaching Captain America Brave New World, right? Like, we got Thunderbolts coming. We got Fantastic Four after that. Just get Captain America out in theaters and move it along. Like, we'll just move it through the pipeline, right? Like, get the interviews out of the way. It's weird that they're not doing big red carpet. It seems strange to me that this is being pinned on the actresses. I think that's really silly. I don't predict. I mean, like, maybe I got this wrong. People are going to call me a shill. I can already see it. If I was doing press at a Disney event, I would not dare ask a question that would get me kicked out of every subsequent Disney event ever. If I had worked my career to do press in movies, I would not go to a Disney event and be like, so tell me about that thing you said about Israel. Like, there's no way. Like, I don't think people are going to do that. That seems like a really silly reason to not do press. It seems more like you're afraid that it's not going to get any kind of big bang on social media. People are going to see the photos and think they look sad, and you don't want to make promotional material featuring these like 7 CGI dwarves you made that your actors and actresses are going to have to take pictures next to. So to avoid a bad photo op functionally, I think, is the reason they're not doing it. But what do I know? They've got some studio cleared photographers to take pictures of it. I think this movie is going to land somewhere in the realm of making its money back and not much more. I don't think it's going to bomb. I think it'll do okay. But I do think Disney's running out of runway here for the live actions. You said it perfect. Like, if for all the ones they got in theaters, there's been a bomb on Disney Plus. For every Cinderella, there's been a Pinocchio, right? Like, for every Alice in Wonderland, oh, I was going to say there's been a Dumbo, but Dumbo came out in theaters. It's a Tim Burton film, for God's sake. Like, they're running out of runway. They're running out of road. And we got live action Lilo and Stitch, which got a trailer just today. We'll probably talk about that next week on the show. They got a live action Moana coming. They got to move here, right? Like, there's nowhere else to go. It seems like they've just got no more space. And it feels like Snow White is obviously coming towards the end of this long line of live actions because it is not a home run hitter. It is a bench seat that's finally just up in line. And they're like, well, we did all the good ones. Time to get the crummy ones out of the way. Let's roll out the 40s Snow White, which is fine. And I like Ziegler. And I like Gal Gadot, honestly, dude. Like, I no hate, but this one just seems so lackluster compared to their others. And they have to know it. They have to know it. I mean, they gotta.
I think despite all that, it might do okay because, again, it's a family-friendly film. You got the Disney brand and the Snow White's well-known. And again, there's nothing else to take the kids. Like, there's just not a lot of things aimed at younger audiences. So it might do well just because of a lack of product, which is sometimes how a film succeeds.
Yeah, that's true. Well, one more story before we pivot into Mickey 17 from the box office. Mickey 17 is not doing that good, right? Bong Joon-ho is a new feature. He won Best Director for Parasite just a few years ago. What the hell's going on, Andy? What's this sluggish U.S. launch?
Although it did win the weekend, it didn't quite meet expectations. They were hoping it was going to open into the mid-20s, and it came in at $19 million, so a little under expectations. It opened up to $50 million globally, which sounds good, but it was a very expensive movie to make, about a $100 million movie, and that's before marketing and stuff, so it probably needs to make like $250 million to break even, and it's probably going to fall well short of that. Which is disappointing because we love original films, and we'll talk about it a little bit more later. But sometimes that's just how it happens, and sometimes it seems that like maybe the budget got away from them a little bit. Some other news: Captain America continues to come in at number 2. It's gonna fall short of its break even point, but it's doing okay. It's limping along okay at a globally $370 million. The underwater thriller with Simu Liu and Woody Harrelson came in at number 3, and Paddington Peru and The Monkey tied for 4th place. So the monkey's still doing good.
I was just telling Chris here at home, I'm so bummed about Paddington and Peru not doing well, but between losing director Paul King and star Sally Hawkins, I think audiences just seem to understand it's just a different thing, and it's not quite the Paddington 3 everybody wanted, and otherwise it's been a bomb here in the States. Glad Monkey's doing okay. I think that one's going to slowly roll out, and that's fine. As for Mickey 17, yeah, dude, weird premise. You got weird actors on the front of it. I'm excited to talk about Mickey 17, actually, but as for the marketing, I think you nailed it. Their budget got away from them. They just spent too much money making this thing. Like, it's too odd. It's too weird. It seems cynical. You have a character that dies a bunch of times. Like, I just don't think general audiences really care for it, right? Like, I'm honestly surprised at how well the movie navigates these spaces, because it seems like it'd be really dark and depressing, and it kind of works great for what the movie is. We'll talk about it here in a second, but like, I don't know. I guess I'm not surprised by it. If anything, I feel like I did about Damon Chazelle's Babylon. Like, well, it probably won't make its money back, but I'm really glad I saw it, and I'm glad it got made. You know, it's one of those movies for the freaks, for the cinema freaks like us, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, I mean, you got to manage budget. And this has been a long time in the making. Like you said, it was actually filmed several years ago. It's just been kind of a slow box office. And again, this is kind of the problem with event filmmaking is that you know, everyone's waiting for the summer stuff to hit, but it's like, we got 2 months to go, baby. Like, what are you going to, you got to get people going to the movies in the in-between times. You can't just depend on the tent poles.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? One more, not even really a story, but just an update regarding our review last week of Ne Zha 2 here in the United States. This is actually getting a theatrical release in Europe, which I guess I kind of thought it already had, but it goes to show how little we know about this movie here in the United States. What's this about, Andy?
I just said it's going to be expanding into some other European territories, Spain, France, Germany, the UK. Which we'll see how it does there. It has officially crossed the $2 billion line, so just barely. Now, the most successful animated film of all time, and also just one of the most successful films of all time. Kind of crazy.
It is. You know, it's funny. I had I met a buddy of mine, actually, to go see Mickey 17 with over the weekend. He'd read the book, Mickey 7, and I hadn't read the book, but I was excited to see the movie. He's an animator in his spare time, and we got to talking about Ne Zha 2, and I said, yeah, we saw this really cool movie. We posted it on YouTube. Review did really well. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. He said, Ne Zha 2? He's like, I don't know that movie. He's like, I saw a movie like a year or two ago called Ne Zha from China with like this little kind of monkey guy and like his friend who's got like water powers. I was like, yeah, Ao Bing. And he goes, oh my God, you know what I'm talking about? I said, yeah, I saw the sequel. He's like, they made a sequel? I'm like, they did. And it's in theaters and you can go enormous. See it now. Crazy. He liked it. He was like, the first one's great. I said, you should go see the second one. It's a lot of fun. Check out the review. We posted an off-script film review. So yeah, nothing but good things about Ne Zha 2. It'll probably do great over in Europe. Probably better than it did here, I'd imagine. Maybe a little bit more a local buzz that way. But either way, we got to talk about this first movie. I'm very excited to get into it. This one is so odd and so weird. And like I said at the top, this is something I'm really glad we watched. I'm going to be taking the summer on this, so please excuse any clumsy delivery. The movie is Mickey 17. So, Mickey 17 is the story of Mickey Barnes, a young man on a dystopian Earth where things are not going good. Owing a little bit of money to a debt collector, Mickey hops a ride on a colony ship going to Niflheim, an ice planet across the galaxy that'll take a few light years to get to. And in order to get on the ship, Mickey signs up to be an expendable, right? A man who will be murdered, basically, in the line of duty and then reprinted out of a human printing machine using cells and cloning and all kinds of goofy science. Mickey subjects himself to this and begins his job on this colony cruiser, dying one by one to nerve gas or an asteroid field or monsters on the planet, until eventually we arrive at Mickey 17, the 17th iteration, played by Robert Pattinson. Mickey 17 is a sci-fi film starring Rob Pattinson, Mark Ruffalo, Toni Collette, Naomi Ackie, and Steven Yeun. And for the most part, Mickey 17 takes place on a large ship plus this planet, Niflheim, as Mickey basically accidentally runs into a future version of himself, Mickey 18, and has to reckon with the idea of, gosh, reincarnation and having a double that does your work for you and has more value than you, so that means something to you in a weird, intrusive way. Mark Ruffalo plays the leader of our colony ship, a dictator-like character who has been compared in kind to, I think, Donald Trump on more than one occasion. I've seen a lot of people post about this. Toni Collette plays his wife. Naomi Ackie is Rob Pattinson's girlfriend. Steven Yeun is his friend. That's pretty much the setup. Once Mickey 17 and Mickey 18 meet each other, they have to figure out how to kind of get along and maybe save society as they know it. I don't want to give too much away, but the movie is Mickey 17 from director Bong Joon-ho, a former director of Parasite. Important to note, this movie was shot in 2022 and came out this year, partly because Warner Brothers hasn't really known what to do with it. And looking at its current box office returns, it seems all too obvious that they knew it wasn't going to make quite its money back. But it's still something cool. And it's actually a lot of fun, I think. And it's inventive in ways that I didn't expect and is based on a book from author, I have his name, Edward Ashton, named Mickey 7, the original book. That's the summary. Andy, what'd you think?
So overall, I definitely enjoyed this, but I think it is a bit of a mess. There are things that work really well, some things quite that don't as well. The setup, like the entire first act is really funny. The sci-fi stuff, I think, is probably what works the best. Like the look of all like the machines and like the spaceship itself is very authentic. Like you feel like you're on like the Nostromo or something out of an alien film. It just feels really authentic. A lot of the, like the kind of experiments and stuff are real gross. There's a lot of Bob Patton like throwing up blood a lot of times. Yeah. And it's all played for comic effect, and there's a charming subplot where he falls in love with one of the kind of police persons on the ship, and they have a romance, and she kind of falls in love with every version of him, his girlfriend throughout the ship. There's a little bit too much going on in the movie, though. There's a lot of subplots. Mickey 18 doesn't show up until about halfway, and the movie kind of turns into something different. So it just kind of lacks a little bit of focus, and it's trying to say a bunch of things. There's a lot of kind of criticisms of capitalism, of just it's very political as well as being very funny. Like all the scientists are kind of very amoral. They're conducting. Part of the reason they're on the ship is because, well, they won't let us do these experiments on Earth, so we're on the ship to do this and learn stuff. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I don't think Mickey 17 is necessarily a good movie, but I had a great time watching it. And it's big sci-fi, big sets. Rob Pattinson is doing so much freak stuff, dude. Like between Mickey 17 and 18, who are two very distinct individual characters. Mickey 17 is so pathetic. He's so pathetic. The first time we meet him in the movie, he's just fallen through this ice ravine. And Steven Yeun, his friend, comes down to save him. And Steven Yeun grabs like his flamethrower. And he's like, I'm cool. You're cool if I leave you here, right? You don't mind. They're just going to print a new one out of you tomorrow. And he's like, yeah, okay, I guess. Yeah. It's like so sad. It's such a sad way to start the movie. And it's great because once we meet Mickey 18 is a polar opposite. He is driven and he's vindictive and he's angry and oddly horny and like very quick to chase revenge. And he's very mad all the time. And it's cool because like you get Pattinson playing both of these really well. Like you get this very serious Rob Pattinson and very goofy Rob Pattinson, and Mickey 17 gets the voiceover in the movie. He's kind of our inner monologue, does this odd sort of voice. Originally he talked about doing a voice that was like Steve-O from Jackass, and apparently Bong Joon-ho is like, he can't do that, that's not gonna work. But what he does is still kind of close. Like he's this kind of odd, sad Midwestern guy with this gravelly voice. And gosh, meanwhile he plays opposite Mark Ruffalo, who's like delightful. Mark Ruffalo is doing such great work outside Marvel. My God. Between Bong Joon-ho and Yorgos Lanthimos, like he's working with weird directors and he's doing big ideas, and his big dictator character is not quite Donald Trump, but like it's also definitely down the avenue of like big boorish dictator who's got big ideas about how things should run, you know, and telling other people what to do. And I love this space colony that they're on. You nailed this perfect after we saw the movie. You said it was more, it's less Parasite and it's more Snowpiercer. And you're absolutely right. Like, I forgot Snowpiercer is a Bong Joon-ho movie. And it totally adds up that it's like this all interiors, like degrading. Everything's kind of rusty and grimy, you know, inside the ship because they've been on there forever. And it's more like a prison colony than it is like any kind of paradise. Like they're very much trapped together, you know? So everybody trying to get along and seeing Mickey as this total expendable is a good setup for comedy and a bit of setup for existential drama, which the movie does a good job of handling.
I wanted to get into performances, I think, to begin with. Starting, of course, with the great Rob Pattinson, who does some really great work here. He does kind of a funny voice. He loves to do a funny voice. He never wants to do his own voice. It's funny. If you saw last year's The Boy and the Heron, he does a crazy voice for that as well. But yeah, he gets to play two very different versions of Mickey. Mickey 17, as we said, is very reserved. He's very kind of quiet, calm, and introverted, very unsure. And then Mickey 18 is kind of a psychopath and the exact opposite. So he gets to do two characters. It gets to do a voice, but then we also have fantastic performances from Mark Ruffalo, like you said, doing the as the politician who can't make it on Earth, so he's going to try and make it as the head of this ship. Toni Collette as his kind of supportive wife. Naomi Ackie is the girlfriend figure. So it's a very fun cast, which I think helps make this work.
Yeah, and really practical. Like, a lot of practical lighting, a lot of practical sets. Like, you can see where a lot of the money went. And it's a bummer, too, because once you get out into the ice planet, it very quickly becomes green screen planet, you know what I mean? Like, doesn't look like they shot a whole lot of outdoors out there. But even still, like, these like monster creatures, aliens that are there are kind of cute and fun in a way that doesn't feel overbearing. If anything, I was worried that the plot was going to feel cynical because you have a main character who's just dying and coming back and dying and coming back. But Mickey seems to not quite retain consciousness, but functionally retain one kind of stream of consciousness through all of these iterations. And he seems to kind of like what he does. He does not see his job as particularly miserable. It's just kind of like how he gets by. So when he runs into his double, Mickey 18, suddenly there's this thought of, wait a second, if you're here already, then when I die, I'm done for good. And like that's not good, dude. Like, I have to have purpose. Like, so that has to mean something larger, like, to me. And that's the start of kind of his journey and the start of his growth. And it's played really great for comedy too, because he is still an expendable. So even though Mickey 17 is trying not to die, his kind of whole job is to get cooked on the ship somehow. Like, usually in a way that he very least expects it. Like, surprise, we sent you out here to die. Or surprise, you're breathing a nerve gas agent you didn't know about. You know, like, just kind of a lot of awful. And you're right, like, the society built around him has no love for expendables. They just very quickly, you know, cook him like it's nothing. He's got his wonderful girlfriend, Nasha, who's very sweet. And some unique ideas when she runs into Mickey 17 and 18 that I thought were really great, that few double movies explore, you know, like, I don't want to get too into it, but like, funny and surprisingly emotional where it needs to be. We should probably talk about the problems with the movie, because there's a few.
Right. There is a ton going on. So I felt like it was pretty focused on the first half. But the premise of there being double, you know, what they call multiples, because they're not supposed to be more than one version of our expendables at any one time. As soon as that happens, we don't really get the trailers and premise have been like, oh, there's two of them. They got to kind of like stay alive. But then it kind of shifts into this other thing about like the inhabitants of the planet and what they want to do with them. And Mark Ruffalo's character starts to like kind of take more center stage. It becomes more of like the political side. So we lose a lot of focus in kind of what the story's about midway through.
Yeah, I think this comes from the adaptation. So I thought it was interesting that it's based on a book, Mickey 7 from Edward Ashton. But when the film ends, the first credit that comes up on screen is written and directed by Bong Joon-ho. Second credit is based on the book, Mickey 7, from director Edward Ashton. Typically, you just say based on, it's an adapted screenplay, but Bong Joon-ho is taking a writing credit here because, took a little research for me to figure this out, Mickey 17 is not actually based on the book that's on shelves, Mickey 7. It's based on a really early version of Mickey 7. Like a really early iterative version of it that apparently Bong Joon-ho had talked to Edward Ashton about, like when he read an old transcript or manuscript or something. And Bong Joon-ho liked that version and kind of ran in this direction and adapted it and changed it to screen and killed Mickey 10 more times, which is why it's Mickey 17 and not Mickey 7, he explained in interviews. But it is not quite like the book. My friend who read it, who I saw it with, was like, there's a lot of differences between the book and the movie. They are not the same. So good to know. If you've already read the book, you're going to get something fresh here. And if you haven't read the book, like, I guess you can go either way, right? You can read it and watch it. You got both options. But I do think that introduces some complications in setup for sure. Like, I felt like the editing is odd in this movie. The pacing's weird. You get some lines that are like 80 yard in there to cover up a scene they might have cut in the editing room. And it's like, okay, there's definitely some finagling that had to happen to get this movie to where it is now. It works, though. I never knew where it was going. Like, I think that's the thing that works the best, is I never knew where Mickey 17 was headed. And I'm typically surprised by the corners it rounds. And by the time you get to the end of it, you end up with this full sci-fi feature with fun sets and really goofy characters that I think kind of works, like, for what it is. Obviously not at the box office. I don't think it's going to make its money back. But I think for those of us that saw it, I think it's a good time.
It also, the pace starts to suffer, I think, towards the end. Like, first hour is great. And then, like I said, as it loses focus, the pace starts to kind of drag. And I kept thinking, oh, we're going to wrap things up soon. And then, no, it just kind of keeps going. And it is long. It's 2 hours, 20 minutes. So it's not a short movie by any means. So I think it could kind of t- tighten up a little bit. It just, like I said, there's just tons of subplots that are eventually come out, and I think that's the undoing of it. And that's what I'd seen a post about that, that it's like, there was another film, Shrinking, that I compared it to, that was like, it's a great premise that is now kind of undermined by its many subplots.
It was a Matt Damon film, right? Shrinking? I never saw that movie, but I remember it. Yeah. Yeah, I can think of three characters off the top of my head you cut out of Mickey 17 and cut 25 minutes off the top of it, and it would still work fine. Like, for sure. But in that way, like, I think there's a lot of attempts at sci-fi, and they don't often work. And the ones that stand out, I think, have to do something different and special. And I think Pattinson brings that. I think Ruffalo brings that. I think Bong Joon-ho, obviously, like, brings his experience to what this is. And though it doesn't, it may not be better than the sum of its parts. Like, the parts that are here are a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed watching it. So yeah, that's Mickey 17. I don't really have any thoughts on. I did like the score. I do recall thinking, but I don't really know who did it. I should probably just move into final recommendations. Any other thoughts for final recommendations?
I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Mickey 17?
I would recommend it for sci-fi fans and fans of Bong Joon-ho. If you're on the fence, you can maybe wait for streaming. It does have a lot going for it. I think it is good sci-fi. It's very convincing in all, like, the machines and the spaceship and all that kind of stuff. We get some interesting ethical questions about the use of clones and space labor, things like that. There's a lot of funny things, a lot of satire, and good performances. It becomes a bit of a mess about halfway through, becomes a little unfocused about what kind of movie it's trying to be, and it feels a little long in the tooth by then at 2 hours and 20 minutes. So for fans of Bong Joon-ho, I would recommend, if you're on the fence, save it for streaming.
I'm in the recommend category. I think this movie's great. Well, I shouldn't say I think it's movie great. It's great, but I think it's a lot of fun. I think you can see the money on screen. I think you should go see it on a big screen if you can. Otherwise, it'll be available on streaming, and you'll probably start it and might get through it all. It is a little long in the tooth, but I think it's good. I really do. I really enjoyed Mickey 17. That was a lot of fun. Would recommend. It's a good time. And with that, we need to move into our next segment. This one's odd. This is unique. We've never really done this on this show formally. We've talked around this loosely, but never gotten too into it. Andy, you want to introduce us here?
Yes. Welcome to the TV Corner. So this is a new segment that we have thought about. People have asked us if we're ever going to review TV shows. For the longest time, we said no. We're strictly a film podcast, but we think we're going to branch out just a little bit and talk a little bit about some shows we're currently watching and then things we're looking forward to this year. I am currently watching Invincible, which is one of my favorite shows of the last few years. This is an animated film or series on Amazon Prime that centers around Mark Grayson, who's a young child whose father is like a Superman-esque character called Omni-Man. And when Mark turns 17, he too gains these Superman-like powers. And so the first season is him very much like coming of age, learning to use his powers, learning to be responsible, which seems very cliche, but it's a very subversive show because Mark just gets beat up like every episode. He like nearly dies despite being invincible, and it's a lot of like learning the hard way of being a superhero. Also, there's a big mystery in the first season in that the kind of what they call the Guardians of the Globe, which is like a Justice League type outfit, all their members are murdered in the first episode. It's a big mystery as to who did this and why it was done. There's really good subplots in each season. A lot of funny characters. There's lots of humor. It's also incredibly violent. Like it starts out looking like a kids animated show, but then there's like really graphic violence. It's written by or created by Robert Kirkman, who famously wrote The Walking Dead. And of course that was adapted into a big successful TV show. So that's what I'm in the middle of watching. We're on season 3, and the season finale is actually tonight, and I'm going to stay up till 2 a.m. and watch it.
Yeah, I have mostly stuck up with Invincible. I've missed the last couple episodes just because they've had this funny release schedule that I think fans were probably aware of. Like the first season came out, and they had a nice long delay between season 1 and season 2. They made a short film, Adam Eve, right, that came out, which is about that character. Like season 3 had a break in the middle of it, now they're back on it. I am a fan of the weekly releases, especially with cinematic television like this, like stuff that's really prestige. Give it time. Like, let each episode breathe. Let the memes build up. Let the hype train roll into the station. You know, all that's important, but it's difficult when there's so much good television out to keep up with Invincible, especially because Invincible comes on the same same night as Severance on Apple TV Plus, which I'm about to talk about here in a second because I really like that show. But would recommend, Andy, you encourage people to check out Invincible?
I strongly recommend. So whenever I watch TV, I usually will give something two or three episodes to see if I'm like into it. And I was hooked on Invincible from the very first episode. Just like the style, the storytelling, kind of, it's pretty gruesome in parts, but every episode generally is like that. And it just has really compelling subplots. So some things are really tragic. There's lots of characters, and it's doing that thing. It reminds me of Hot Fuzz, where it's both a parody and a satire of the superhero genre, but also some very good superhero storytelling. So yeah, highly recommend.
Yeah, postmodern superhero work a la Watchmen. It's funny, I agree with the large number of subplots in Invincible. I actually like that because so many of them are very comic book oriented. My struggle with the show currently is my least favorite characters are kind of the ones in the A plot, kind of our main characters. But that, I think that's appropriate because I know it's based on a comic book series that's further ahead than the show is. And from what I've read, our lead Mark is going maybe headed into some dark corners, like darker than usual. And I think maybe that's the way I'm supposed to feel. I think the show's kind of shaped that way. So it's good stuff. I got to catch up on it. The other thing I've been watching is Severance on Apple TV Plus. This show comes from Ben Stiller at Red Hour Productions. This is the show he's been working on since he directed Escape from Dannemora over on Showtime. What if you could skip your job, right? What if you could walk into work and as soon as you walk through the doorway into your office or retail location, wherever you work, you could skip to 5 o'clock and be walking out the other side? That is the subject of Severance, a show about not working or skipping work if you can. Adam Scott plays Mark S., a man who has signed up to work at Lumen, a big corporation, as a severed worker, a man who has a chip implanted in his brain, and every time he goes down the elevator to work, he changes over into his what's called an innie, the inward version of himself, the person who works at Lumen, and he works in MDR, macro data refinement, with three other wonderful coworkers, Zach, Irving, and Helly, all fantastic. When he leaves work, Mark turns back into his Audi version of himself, who has no idea what he does for a living and doesn't know what he does at work. Doesn't matter. He just gets a paycheck from Lumen and life's pretty good. In the meantime, Mark is mourning the death of his wife, who has passed away in a tragic accident. It's how he ended up working at Lumen to kind of get away from the depressions of reality. But it turns out there's more than meets the eye to Lumen. And the work they're doing, while mysterious and important, is definitely important in ways that they can only begin to comprehend. And as MDR begins to tug at the threads of what's really happening down in the severed floor at Lumen, things begin to become clear that maybe weren't before. The show's currently in its second season. It's on Apple TV Plus. It is hands down my favorite show on TV right now. I think it's so cool. And it's so not for everybody because it's heavy sci-fi, but I think it's really special. And just like Invincible, they've just got a couple episodes left until season 2 is done. It is a great time to check it out if you haven't yet. And you've watched a little bit of Severance. From your initial impressions, what do you think?
Yeah, so I watched, again, I mentioned that I would usually give something two or three episodes. I did give it 3 episodes, and I thought it was interesting, but I also like couldn't quite get hooked on it, and then I just never went back and finished it, and now I'm way behind on season 2, so I may never catch up. Maybe if I have a long break, maybe over the summer, I'll catch up on it. But it was, again, a very interesting premise, and also kind of parallels between Mickey 17 and also The Substance, about kind of having a doppelganger that, you know, kind of fills out part of your life.
Yeah, and Different Man, starring Sebastian Stan, that we saw earlier this year. Yeah, this theme of doubles, like, and having a double that, like, goes to work for you or, like, has more value than you do in a capitalist system is interesting. And there seem to be a lot of those this year in particular. So, yeah, we're going to have to talk about that in a larger capacity at some point. But Severance is amazing. I think it is so cool. I think it will become, I think both of these shows will get a lot of attention come next Emmys. And you heard it here first on Offscript, folks. Why can't we talk about cinematic television, huh? Why not? It's right. So much like film, we might as well. So yeah, that's Invincible and that's Severance. Would recommend. That's an easy recommend for me. Like I said, both these shows only have an episode or two left until they're done for the season. Like, no better time to jump in and check them out. I'm assuming both of these have future seasons to come. So would recommend. It's Invincible and Mickey 17. It's Invincible and Severance. And with that, we should move into our final review of the episode.
Whoa, whoa.
Well, did I go too far? Did I mess up?
Oh, well, I did.
We did. We, in addition to our TV corner, sorry, we are also going to be talking about some shows that we're looking forward to coming out the rest of the year. We often do this with movies. We compiled a list of things we're looking forward to. Up first, probably closest, is The Last of Us Season 2, which comes out on April 13th, for about a month away. Season 1, masterpiece of television. One episode 3 specifically, Long, Long Time, if you've seen that. Usually, like a kind of season finale or maybe a mid-season thing is like the best episode. And this third episode of this that came out of nowhere is like literally one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen. Also starring Nick Offerman in that season. But season 2 is just around the corner. I don't want to get too much into these. We'll be here forever. Yeah. It, Welcome to Derry, which is a prequel series in the taking place in the world of Stephen King's It, comes out this fall. We don't know much about it. We haven't really seen anything other than it's just going to be take place even before the events from that we know in the book, probably, and the series. Really looking forward to that. Zach, why don't you take the next couple?
Yeah. A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms is coming to HBO this summer. It's the next Game of Thrones series, right? They did House of the Dragon recently, Game of Thrones before that, of course. Knight of the Seven Kingdoms is a bit more singular. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know it's going to be set in Westeros. I know it's going to have that Game of Thrones budget, so keep an eye out. Also, The Bear, season 4 over on Hulu. Dude, The Bear rocks. The Bear took a bunch of Emmys home last year at the Emmys, and it's fantastic, starring Jeremy Allen White, Ayoade Barry, our new thing. Oh my God. Not Ben Grimm. I can't remember
Emmett Moss Backrack.
Cousin. That's it. Emmett Moss. Yeah. He's fantastic. They're all fantastic. It's a great show worth watching. Big comedy. Lots of fun. It's not even really about cooking all that much. I mean, it kind of is, but also not really. And then Alien Earth, coming from Noah Hawley over on FX. This is that Alien show. The show from Alien. You know, like Alien, like the movie Alien and Aliens, those aliens. Yeah. Well, they're coming to Earth, I think. In some capacity. And outside of a teaser, I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know it's coming this summer. It looks all right, right? And Alien Earth looks all right.
Yeah, we don't know too much about that other than like somehow a xenomorph, something or other, ends up on Earth. And that is a prequel to the entire Alien franchise. I'm not real sure how that's going to work out timeline-wise, but that's definitely something that I'm going to look forward to. A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms is going to be a kind of a smaller Game of Thrones property. It's only going to be 6 episodes. It centers around Duncan the Tall, who is a hedge knight. So that's a quick season, 6 episodes. Love the Bear. Definitely looking forward to that. A big one, which I'm not into, but I felt like we had to mention, is Stranger Things season 5. This will be the final season. I cannot believe how long it's taking them to do this show. It's been 10 years of Stranger Things, and they're only on the 5th season. I stopped watching after the 3rd season, which I only like half watched, so I don't even know what's going on. The episodes are like 90 minutes long, and I'm just like, I couldn't do it. But that's going to be a big one for July, probably. Zach, are you a Stranger Things fan?
I watched season 4. I'm caught up, at least, so I think by default I have to be, but no, I don't own any merch or anything. I think season 4 is the best one they've had since season 1. But I get why you and everybody else are so burnt on it, dude. It's like, what, I'm supposed to watch 90 minutes an episode, every episode, to get through these things now? And I think the next one's like, and 5's like even longer. It's like, dude, what are we doing here? You know, like, they're crazy long. One other show we're talking about. Go ahead.
Real quick, the first season of Stranger Things is a masterpiece. I remember seeing a trailer for that way back in 2015 and thinking, oh man, this looks really good. And it was. And it then became this hit phenomenon thing. Kids on bikes, but now like they've been at it so long, the kids are so old, they're like in their mid-20s, like they're gonna have kids of their own soon. Like, it's just taken so long.
The first season of Stranger Things like genuinely changed how we think. I mean, it's part of the reason we're doing this segment right now. It was a Netflix original. It was one of their early ones. We were like, what, Netflix is doing their own TV? I will see what this is like. And they had a couple shows out, but nothing really that hit. And I have distinct memories of my sister coming over to my little one bedroom apartment at the time and hanging out with me that evening and being like, hey, I watched this show, Stranger Things, you should watch it. And I was like, what? She was like, you haven't heard about this? Dude, we'll watch it right now. So she puts on the episode on my TV in my living room. I was like, yeah, okay, we'll check this. This is just something. By the end of that hour, I was so stoked to hit episode 2, dude. I was like, this is incredible. Like, this is one of the best things I've ever seen. I stayed up and watched 2 more episodes that night. I went to work the next day. I was always thinking about it. I was like, I got to get home and watch more Stranger Things. Like, I can't wait. They dropped the whole season. They hadn't really done that before. Like, genuinely changed the way we talk about TV today. I'm glad they're wrapping it up, though. My God, it's been like a decade. How are we still talking about Stranger Things? Like, they gotta move through it. One more show, I'll move through this fast. Righteous Gemstones. HBO's got the Righteous Gemstones season 4 coming out. What a show. Big comedy from Danny McBride about Texas megachurches. Not really Texas. I guess they're just megachurches in the South. But being that I'm from Texas, I sure feel a relation to it. It is such a goofy show about the three up-and-coming heirs, I guess I should say, to one megachurch pastor, played by John Goodman, his three comedy kids who are just awful and awful to each other and don't deserve anything and totally want a piece of the pie. It's like kind of like Succession, but told from the perspective of Danny McBride and not really serious at all. Tremendous. Super funny, very goofy, very crass. Love Righteous Gemstones. You just checked out an episode of Righteous Gemstones yesterday, Andy, right?
Yeah, so I haven't really watched this show. I've seen like some clips of it here and there, but I actually watched the first season of season 4. I think it's the first episode I've watched from beginning to end. Great stuff. Great stuff. And even knowing just a little bit about what I do about the show.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun. Would recommend. All great stuff. All great content. We got to talk about TV more on here. I'm curious to see how it performs, you know, in the algos. Does this help us? Do we do better?
We'll see what the people want.
Yeah, it's got to be. Anyway. One more movie to talk about before we wrap up this week. Very excited to get to this one because it's very different. It's very strange. And it's not like others. Not like the others, I don't think. Andy's going to take the summary on it. Andy, please, take it away.
Chaos, the Manson Murders. So this is a new documentary from a famed documentarian, Earl Morris, who's done, he won an Oscar back in early 2000s, 2003, I think. Yes. Famously made one called The Thin Blue Line that I think was in the 80s. A man was set free or retried or something. Zach will tell us more. Anyways, but we saw that this new documentary was out on Netflix and that it was by Earl Morris, so we decided to check it out. It is about the 1969 Manson murders of actress Sharon Tate and her colleagues in the August of 1969. World famous case, very famous, has been lots of media made over. So it was interesting to kind of see this new take. Earl Morris is kind of interested in a number of aspects of it. We learned a little bit about the backstory of the Manson family. There's this really interesting aspect of like the CIA being involved and like possibly testing LSD on people unknowingly. In an attempt to learn more about mind control, we learn about kind of the underworld that's going on, some drug deals that go bad, and other kind of just vice things going on. There's a section about the murders themselves, the fallout, the trial, the kind of aftermath, the big questions of like how did he control these people to get these people to do these things for him. So it's a look at all these different aspects of it. And this is a tough thing to cover just because it's been covered so much. So Morris is trying to find a new lens with which to kind of view these through. So, Zach, what did you think?
So Chaos is based on the book, Chaos the Manson Murders is based on the book Chaos by Tom O'Neill, which is about Manson and about the CIA and about how their experiments with LSD to lead to mind control may have influenced the Manson family. Like in the way that Charles Manson influenced his family to do what they want, right? Like pure mind control. Somebody will go kill for you. That is the angle Errol Morris is attacking this at. And he's using Tom O'Neill, who's featured heavily in the documentary, as a subject to talk about this and explore these ideas. I think Morris is a great documentarian. I really do. Like Thin Blue Line in 1988 fundamentally changed the way we understand documentaries today. One of its biggest innovations outside of basic reenactment, which is something that like sounds goofy to say that like, what do you mean? They do that in every documentary. If I'm watching a crime procedural, they're going to have shots of like a couple actors kind of reenacting the crime, right? Thin Blue Line nearly started that. He was basically the first one to be like, hey, what if we reset this and shoot it like dramatically and pose it in this thing as footage? And it works. Like the idea of recording a phone call and cutting to a tape recorder that's running as the phone call is listening, so you have visuals to pair with it, that comes from Errol Morris in 1988. Like Huge innovations in the documentary space. In 2003, he wins the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature for The Fog of War, which is about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Like, big, big ideas. This whole thing is getting to the epistemology of, like, who his subjects are. So his ability to interview Tom O'Neill here and Tom O'Neill's idea is important. Problem is, this is a Netflix true crime documentary. And Netflix knows that, like, people aren't going to care about a documentary about Tom O'Neill and the CIA and LSD experiments. We got to put the Manson murders on the front of it and put Charlie Manson's face on it. That's what's going to get people to click, right? And that's, I think, the biggest weakness of the movie is the parts that are so purely Netflix. So much of this has to fit into this true crime framework that he doesn't do a whole lot. Like, typically his documentaries are much more character oriented, and he does character orientation here, but it's wrapped around a Netflix true crime documentary. It's a story a lot of us are already kind of familiar with. And no, if you don't know the Manson story, like, it's definitely worth watching, but I think it doesn't do a very good job at telling it. It's kind of boring and it's a lot of text and it's presented well. I'm going to talk about that in a second, but it's just kind of like misleading. I think it's not, it's more than meets the eye. It's not what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. It's a little dry somehow, even though it's this, you know, tantalizing murder case that everyone knows or has heard about. Somehow it manages to not be super interesting. And I think part of the problem is that usually a documentary will have a lot of documentary footage. In other words, like TV footage or like news footage or like some sort of actual things on camera. And this seems to kind of lack a lot of that.
Yeah.
Like there's footage of Manson and some of the victims. Sharon Tate was a very famous actress at that point. Roman Polanski's wife at the time as well. But there's a lot of just like, yeah, looking at photos or like you were talking about the tape recorder, trying to make still images seem dramatic. Yes. And it's recordings, it's reenactments, it's newspaper headlines. And it's a whole lot of not what you normally see. There's also, it looks like they clearly went out and got like drone footage of L.A., just to put in there. Just there's a lot of that kind of fill. Get us some B-roll.
Yeah.
To fill this in. And it's just, it's not really interesting. There's some weird things if you're watching the video with like these Manson puppets. Again, just meant to fill in the space. And again, it doesn't, that was going to be one of my criticisms. It's like, it doesn't really talk about the victims very much. We don't really get to know them hardly at all. And that's one of the biggest criticisms of true crime, that it tends to be less about the victims and more about the criminals.
Yeah, like it seems like Morris's core idea here is to dig at Tom O'Neill's insinuation that the CIA fundamentally caused the Manson murders. Like, basically inadvertently, in so far as to say that Charlie Manson may have directly been influenced by a member of the CIA, a high-ranking individual. He's got a name, he's got photos, he's got interview footage of him. That stuff's great. The footage of the Manson family members in prison years later doing interviews and being like, well, I didn't know, I just did what he said. That stuff's great. The stuff that doesn't work is the loads of text treatment. There's so much text in this movie. Like cut to a headline, cut to a statement, cut to an article. Like, and it's played well through clever editing. It's a lot of like grunge textures and like red coloring and like sliding in and making things look like they're in like a scanner. And that stuff works great if you're into like After Effects texturing, dude. Like it's great stuff. And I also like the way Morris shoots his interviews. He does two things. Either A, he will shoot his interviews in a location of the subject's choosing that they like Tom O'Neill's office, where he is surrounded by books and folders of papers and loose stacks and binders. Like everywhere you look, he's surrounded. And Morris brings 12 cameras. And he puts them in the oddest places. One's outside the doorway and framed this way, and one's over here behind his shoulder. He even does this split perspective shot through chunks of it, where it's two camera angles at the same time showing the same footage to give you these thoughts of perspective and like who we're seeing and how they see it and what we're talking about. It's subliminal. It's stuff I like the most. The other way he shoots his interviews is with his patented Interatron, which is a real phrase that I can't believe. The Interatron, Errol Morris invented, and it sounds bonkers, but basically what it is it's two teleprompters set on two cameras where you can see your interviewer's face directly down the lens. So you get these interviews where your documentary subject is looking directly at the lens talking to Errol Morris, but we don't see that. We just see the documentary subject talking directly to us. And he's got a few of those in here. Like, it'll be an interview where the person is just looking straight down the lens. What they see is Errol Morris's face, and they're talking back and forth. What we see is a perfect down the lens look at our subject, like, which is piercing and catches attention in a way. But those parts of the movie that I like the most, like, those are bookends, the beginning and the end. And the middle of it is like just a kind of clunky, generic Netflix true crime doc that doesn't work that good. And it bums me out, dude. Morris is 77. My man's old. Like, I don't want to say he's losing it. I don't want to say he's missing a step, because I think the presentation's great. But yeah, just this like dedication to like, oh, well, we have to make this less about LSD mind control and more about the Manson murders for an hour is distracting and doesn't work, I think, in the way that's intended.
Yeah, I thought that the opening premise about like the CIA mind control having and could have had something to do with this, I think is very interesting. Like, it's a very bold idea. And yeah, then it just kind of gets tucked away for like the whole middle, like the whole hour in the middle, while it's kind of going through the motions of like the Manson family, there were them living at Spahn Ranch and like them being involved with this health clinic in San Francisco, and then like the some drug deals gone wrong, which leads to several murders, which eventually leads to the famous Manson murders, that all those things that people are a little bit more familiar with. And then at the very end, it kind of gets back into the like, oh, there was a CIA guy who was kind of in touch with the whole thing. So it doesn't really tie it all together very well.
I know. It bums me out, man. I was really looking forward to this being a banger. I had no idea it was coming out. Morris kind of took a break after his former editor passed away. I don't recall her name, but he had worked with her on like everything. And just a few years ago, she kind of passed. And then I think in 2023, he kicked off like a couple features. And then this came out and I was like, oh God, Errol Morris is making things. I figured he's in his 70s. He's probably done. But apparently not. And like, for what's here, it's good, but it's just not as concentrated as his other work. And it feels like part of that is just the Netflix angle. We got to make this marketable. We want people to click on it. It ends up feeling so much more like just a generic Netflix doc. And it bums me out, because I think Morris has a lot of talent. I think this story is pretty compelling, but it's just, I don't know. It just doesn't get over the line for me. It's a bummer. So any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
I think I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Chaos, the Manson Murders?
This is a pass for me, a rare pass where I didn't really enjoy it. It's only 85 minutes and it still felt long, felt like it dragged. If you don't know anything about the Manson Murders, it probably is very educational in that aspect. The whole CIA thing is an interesting point, but it's like when people try to connect Lee Harvey Oswald to the JFK assassination and CIA stuff there. It's a real weak connection. It's not well explored. It seems very exploitative of its victims. It doesn't talk about them very much. So I think it's going to be a pass for me.
I think I'm kind of in the same boat. I think it's some of Errol Morris's, I don't want to say his weakest work, but like definitely weaker. Not his strongest. Yeah, weaker. There you go. That's the term. It's weaker work. I would recommend four other documentaries from him before I'd say check this one out. Like, it ends up just feeling a bit too generic. It's just a bit too Netflix. If you have seen the Manson story and you're familiar with it and you think there might be more at play, okay. Like, I think the angle that this documentary presents is intriguing and draws interest in that way, with CIA mind control and manipulation. But if you're not familiar with it, like, it's a lot more fun to go watch like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and just kind of find it along the way. You know what I mean? Like, the presentation here is just a little dry. Bums me out. Like, I like Morris. I like him a lot. You should definitely check out some of his other work. Thin Blue Line Rocks from 88. God, he's got movies in the Criterion Collection, for God's sake. The man made a television show, Andy. Anyway, we got to stop talking about Errol Morris. That's it for episode 285 of Off Script. My God. What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I'd say, do you have a favorite? What would be your top Errol Morris documentary?
Man, I've been thinking a lot about A Brief History of Time. He did a documentary with Stephen Hawking that Stephen Hawking entirely narrates. And it's supposed to be about his book, A Brief History of Time, which is Hawking's like theorizing on how space moves in the physical world. But it ends up being all about Hawking and about who he is and how he got to be where he is. And I haven't seen it in years. I don't even think it got a Blu-ray. I think it's DVD only. It's great. I recently bought His first two films, Gates of Heaven and Vernon, Florida, they're both in the Criterion Collection in a rare dual disc for Criterion. There's both of them on one thing. They're fantastic. I'd say if you wanted to try out something new from him, Netflix did a film called Tabloid with him a few years ago. Tabloid rocks. It's very current. It's about a young, glamorous, kind of up-and-coming pop star in the 70s who, through getting married to a Mormon, functionally gets kidnapped and ends up having to, like, escape. She tells this whole story. There's all this crazy footage. Tabloid rocks. Like, I think Morris is great. I think this is a good project. I hope what he does next is better. So yeah, that's Chaos. My gosh. Episode 285, done and dusted behind us, Andy. What are we watching next week?
So we're going to be taking a look at Opus, which is starring Ayo Itabiri, which is a bit of a horror comedy, possibly. Her character gets invited to go to this island of a pop star who's kind of gone into hiding for like 15 years, and he's finally going to like come out, and you know, it'd be like if you got invited to, I don't know, Michael Jackson's ranch or something. Probably not a great example, but wow. But it's that kind of thing. So she gets invited to like this super secret thing. Not everything is as it seems. Also stars John Malkovich and Juliette Lewis. We're also going to be taking a look at The Electric State, which is the new like $300 million movie from Netflix starring Millie Bobby Brown, Chris Pratt, and others, Woody Harrelson. I watched the trailer for this. It involves some like post-apocalyptic thing where there's robots and humans and they don't get along, but then the robots and humans like team up against a common enemy. This doesn't look great, but it's a huge movie that a lot of people, there's a lot of buzz about, so we're gonna watch it, let you know what it's all about. Some FYI releases, Novocaine, the action comedy, romance comedy starring, oh gosh, Jack Quaid.
Yes.
Comes out this week. Also on March 15th, Black Bag, which is Steven Soderbergh's spy thriller with Michael Fassbender and
Kate Blanchett, right?
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. That's out this week as well in theaters. And The Outrun is going to be on Netflix this weekend as well. And that was, of course, Saoirse Ronan's big kind of Oscar vehicle, which didn't really get recognized, but that's out as well.
Last week's episode of Nazha 2 did great. Did great. And we're really excited about the performance. So if you listened last week or you watched, thank you for checking it out. If you haven't, dude, slide over to YouTube and check out what we got going on. Big things going on over on YouTube. We love our audio listeners. Google Play, Spotify, iHeartVideo, iHeartMedia, iHeartRadio, Amazon. Our audio podcast is available everywhere. Go check us out there. If you're not able to watch us on video, we're on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all the usual social media places. You can like, follow, comment, subscribe, rate, review, notification bell, all the social media stuff. And I know I say that all wrapped up together. I promise any little bit helps. One like, one watch, a comment, every little bit helps us move around. We really appreciate the work. We really appreciate you guys checking us out week over week. And gosh, you can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com. You can email us correspondence directly from you guys to us, from your mouth to our ears at mail at offscriptfilmreview.com. God, that's Off Script episode 285. Come back next week for 286. And that's the whole kit and caboodle. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.